Hi, I'm Carolyn Beeler. I'm the environment correspondent and editor at The World. For the past several years, I've been covering what I see as the biggest story of our time, climate change. I've traveled to the face of a melting glacier in Antarctica. I've been in the room as world leaders hammer out agreements at UN climate summits. And I've seen cutting-edge carbon capture projects being built under the sea floor. I will never, ever forget sitting with a family in Pakistan who'd lost almost everything, their home and livestock and most of their belongings after catastrophic flooding turned their town into a lake. The story of climate change can feel really big and overwhelming, but being able to sit down and talk with people across the globe about what they're experiencing and how they're trying to help, that makes this story real and immediate. But we cannot do this work without your support. As we close in on the end of the year, we're aiming to raise $67,000, and we are counting on you to help get us there. A generous donor, thank you, has offered to match your gift one-to-one up to that $67,000. That means if you give $50, The World gets $100. If you give $250, The Newsroom receives $500. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation. That is theworld.org/give. I really can't emphasize enough how much your support means to our newsroom. Thank you. And now, on to the show. This holiday weekend, we're giving thanks to people who are doing something about climate change. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll visit the Amazon, where the focus is on deforestation,
fighting criminal actions like clear cuts and fires, while also supporting the local economy.
Talk to the mayor of Freetown, Sierra Leone, about the limits of resilience.
That's like putting a bandage on the wound. It's not really the answer.
And head to a town in Iceland that aims to be carbon neutral in just 8 years.
You can rent a scooter. We have our charging stations for the electric cars all around town. So there are no excuses.
Plus, inspiration from the musician Dilu.
Yes, it's dramatic. Yes. Yes, it's really sad, but the actions that we're taking, making the change, could be joyful and beautiful.
We're all about climate solutions today on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Thanks for spending part of the holiday weekend with us. We're stepping back from the daily news today to focus on people who are working toward solutions, specifically solutions to climate change.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
All this hour, we're revisiting stories from our series, The Big Fix, about people who are bending the curve of climate warming emissions or working to better handle the impacts of climate change. We start in Akureyri, Iceland. It's a small city, population 18,000, with a big goal: to become the world's first carbon-neutral city by 2030. In other words, Akureyri is aiming to emit less greenhouse gas than it absorbs. The World's Jerry Haddon visited last summer.
There are really just two things keeping Akureyri from becoming carbon-neutral. The first is most people, like me, fly in on commercial jets. That carbon footprint is giant. But once you're here on the ground, it can almost feel like a challenge to find ways to pollute.
So I'm going to get from the airport to the city on a electric scooter. I'm going to scan the barcode here, and I'm good to go. From the airport into Akureyri, the town, there's a dedicated bike path and scooter path, and it's about 10 minutes, carbon-free.
Well, you might think not entirely carbon-free, because you have to charge the scooter's battery. That uses energy. But 100% of Akureyri's electricity comes from hydroelectric plants, like this one built along a narrow, snow-fed river cascading down a mountain.
The power installation is, I think it's 3.3 megawatts. In a year, it can probably produce electricity for around, somewhere between 8 and 10,000 electric vehicles.
That's Gudmundur Sigurdarsson. He's the visionary behind Akureyri's carbon-neutral plans.
In theory, we could produce all the electricity we need for transportation from the local river.
Sigurdarsson's also the town's informal spokesman and a guide for all things green.
We want the people that are living here in Akureyri to have all the opportunity to live as green lifestyle as possible.
You can rent a scooter. We have our charging stations for the electric cars all around town. We have the recycling stations and all that. So there are no excuses to not take part in this green wave.
Just about everything is recycled here, from soda cans and plastic water bottles to heat-trapping greenhouse gases like methane. Sigurd Larsson walks me up to the top of a grassy hill just outside town.
Under here we have, you know, cars, animals, jeans, everything. As it was not mapped out, so we had to drill test holes and just see how much gas was being produced.
This was once Akureyri's main landfill. You'd never know it was here, but for the dozens of black pipes sticking up from the ground. The pipes capture the tons of rising methane that would otherwise escape into the atmosphere over time. Instead, the greenhouse gas gets pumped to a storage station for refinement as a fuel to run the town's buses.
I don't have any change on me. How much?
It's free.
It's free?
Yeah.
These buses, I learned, cost nothing to ride. So, as Sigurd Larsson might say, you've got no excuse not to use them. Same goes for these cooking oil recycling bins. The drop-off points are everywhere. The oil gets turned into biodiesel for ships. In fact, nothing organic in Akureyri goes to waste. Uneaten food, grass clippings, animal carcasses.
There's a horses and pigs today. So.
This is Christian Olafsson, manager at the local composting plant called Morta. He's showing me a long conveyor belt piled with animal remains.
It just comes like that from the slaughterhouses.
And do you get used to that smell?
Yeah.
All the stuff here gets blended together, then sits for months in piles outside, fermenting. Olafsson shows me the final product, a mound of garden-ready compost, and it, too, is free.
No smell, a lot of nutrients, and somewhere they call it black gold, because you see almost the black.
It will make things grow.
Yeah, for sure.
This is the last stop on Gudmundur Sigurdarson's green tour, maybe because of the view here over the town, the fjord, or because the Morta plant embodies what Akureyri is shooting for.
We talk about Morta as the climate hero, because every kilogram that goes into this plant instead of landfill reduces the emission of 1 kilogram CO2.
In other words, carbon neutrality. But as I said, there are two things slowing Akureyri's progress towards that goal. The first was planes, the second, cars. Gas and diesel guzzling cars. There are some 16,000 of them in town, says Sigurd Larsson. That's about 2 per licensed driver. Getting people to go electric is proving tough, despite all the charging stations. Electric vehicles are expensive. And Akureyri has a deeply rooted old-fashioned car culture. In fact, there's a parade here every Wednesday. Dozens of guys in vintage vehicles gather along the fjord, then roll out for a slow cruise, creating a lot of noise and exhaust. I look under a couple of hoods before the fun begins.
It's Skoti, from Czechoslovakia, 64.
And it runs on a lithium battery, is that right?
No. Here we have gasoline.
That is Volvo Amazon, 1963.
I see. Yeah. But do you ever have a slight feeling like maybe I should give up gasoline cars and...
Not yet. I'm too old for it. I'm 66 now, so maybe I'd be buried in a car like this.
These are hardly the voices of a green revolution. But to be fair, it's a small group. And Akureyri did have a milestone to celebrate around this year's summer solstice. The number of electric vehicles registered in the town hit 1,000. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Akureyri, Iceland.
The impacts of climate change can be seen all over the West African city of Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone. There are landslides in the hills, erosion on the coast, and annual flooding. The port city of about 1 million people is growing fast, which is exacerbating the problem. Urban sprawl has led to massive deforestation, and unregulated development has made flooding worse. But Freetown's mayor says the most notable impact of climate change so far is actually invisible.
Like many places, one of the most striking impacts now is extreme heat.
Yvonne Aki Sawyer is serving a second term as mayor of the city where she grew up. She shot to international prominence when she was first elected with a plan to make Freetown climate resilient. I spoke with Aki Sawyer this fall on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York.
This year, the lack of rainfall has been marked. Another major impact from my city of climate change, it has, as we all know, really damaging effect on crop cycles. When you're a subsistence farmer, that means you kind of like live from day to day. What you farm is what you eat and sell, and then you haven't got the stores nor the technology to really have much of a cushion. When your harvests are hit, you often become desolate, and what people do? Migrate to the city. So we've seen massive rural urban migration. That's added vulnerability to existing vulnerability. And one of the worst impacts of this has been deforestation. So for those of you who don't know, Freetown is the capital city of Sierra Leone, and it's on the Atlantic Ocean. It's nestled between the ocean and a range of mountains. I grew up with those mountains being totally green and literally just growing up in forests. You know, everywhere was forest. And in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen so much of that disappear.
You began a tree planting campaign as part of your efforts to make the city more resilient, plant a million trees. How is that effort going?
The tree planting program is known as hashtag Freetown the Tree Town. And it's not just planting a million trees, it's growing. To date, we have 850,000 in the ground. Green jobs are created by this. The young people on this program, the young people who work on this program, get paid based on the tracking of the trees. So we created a digital app, a tree tracker app, which is connected to a database, and we do a physical audit. And based on that audit, which is done independently, we've had an 82% survival rate, which is really high for tree planting programs. And that's why we say we're not planting trees, we're growing trees.
I understand that the goal was to have a million trees planted by 2022. You're saying you're going to meet it this year in 2023. Yes. What happened there? What went wrong? And are there any lessons learned that you can share from that?
So the reason it went from 2 to 3 was finance. If we had the money, we would have done it immediately. I mean, of course, you've got some lead time because you've got to nurse the seedlings. But definitely with more finance, we could do more and we could do it faster.
The impact of climate change on Freetown is not unique. As you're talking to mayors from other urban areas, are there secrets to success that you'd share with them?
I would say one of the most important things is take your community along with you. Make sure your residents are informed and understand, because they're your biggest partners. We did this first with Transform Freetown, which is our wider SDG.
Sustainable Development Goals, a UN program.
Yes, of course.
For our listeners.
For listeners, the SDGs are the Sustainable Development Goals. And what was interesting is that we had developed and designed Transform Freetown. And then afterwards, I came across the SDGs, did an alignment, did a matrix, and everything we're doing was meeting one of the SDGs or more, multiple SDGs. So I think what that tells you is that it's about meeting the needs of people. You know, you can use all kinds of acronyms, you can use all sorts of fancy words, all sorts of vocabulary, but if you're just speaking to people and understanding their needs and working to meet those needs, we will tick the boxes of what needs to be done. Have effective communication. You know, I was in a market and the market woman called me, I'm going to say this in Creole, the mamina Facebook, the woman on Facebook. And it's because I speak to my city, I speak to my residents, very active on social media, which is where people are. And of course, we need to build on our revenue base locally, but where we are today, local financing is not enough. We're facing a crisis, and for many countries, many cities in the developing world, it's a crisis we didn't create, and it's a crisis which is coming at us like a tsunami.
I wanted to talk about like informal settlements and flooding. Floods are killing people every year in Freetown, especially in the informal settlements or slums. How are you addressing that issue with an eye toward better urban planning?
I think the most effective thing I could implement is something I am not able to do urban planning, to issue building permits, to be able to have the tools to prevent this illegal construction and the explosion of slums. So what would I do? What would I love to do? I'd love to be able to have a building permit regime so that I can stop people from constructing where they're not supposed to construct and where it's going to make them more vulnerable. We cannot keep moving forward and expect the resilience we need without planning effective planning being a part of that equation.
Aki Sawyer is the mayor of Freetown, Sierra Leone. I caught up with her on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. Still ahead this hour, more stories of resilience and solutions to climate change. It's our Big Fix special edition of The World.
Most people think they know all they need to know about Christian rock.
Whether you think it's cheesy propaganda pretending to be cool,
or if you think it's the only pop music unsullied by worldly vices,
you'll find something to love on Rock That Doesn't Roll.
I'm Leah Payne, author of A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
And I'm Andrew Gill, a public radio producer who grew up on Christian rock.
On Rock That Doesn't Roll, we're talking with people who loved Christian rock in its peak era and learning how it affected them as they grew up.
Listen to Rock That Doesn't Roll wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories
as we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise.
What is a mother, we ask?
And everything answers.
Mother is a question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. And this is our special hour covering climate solutions. Climate change, of course, does not persist in a vacuum. It dovetails with lots of other issues, including war. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, for example, has had a huge impact on fossil fuels. Who's buying them, who's exporting them, and our efforts to replace them with cleaner energy. Russia's war in Ukraine sent energy prices sky high 21 months ago, and that triggered a change in global energy markets.
Something dramatic has started to shift.
Tim Gould is the chief energy economist at the International Energy Agency.
What's happened as a result of these very high fuel prices that we've seen is that many countries have doubled down on clean energy technologies.
Gould says when viewed through the lens of history, the war in Ukraine will be seen as an important turning point in the world's reaction to climate change.
We are not reacting fast enough, but some important things have changed. Policies have become stronger. Deployment of important technologies has become stronger as well.
That's especially true in Europe, Gould says. But he also points to the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act as a notable policy response. Gould says this is changing the trajectory for fossil fuel demand. The International Energy Agency thinks that demand will peak before the end of this decade.
I think it's quite an important moment in energy history. The aggregate picture is one where the fossil fuel demand starts to flatten out and then starts to decline.
That's still a few years away, but we have a specific example now of one country that has doubled down on clean energy after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That country is Germany. Some of its ambitious new policies are going well. Others are facing headwinds. Reporter Brett Simpson brings us this story from Berlin.
It's a bright June day in Berlin, and four ultralight solar panels lining the front of a balcony are soaking up the sun. They're hanging from Velcro straps just below some flower boxes.
So it's just plugged into a power socket that pushes energy into the house or into the apartment.
That's Carolina Atspadina, co-founder of the startup We Do Solar. This balcony is at her office, where she's showing me her product. Easy to install, plug-and-play, at-home solar.
Anyone can actually put it up on their balcony, no matter whether they're tech-savvy or not. And everything works from a normal power socket.
On a sunny day like today, these panels can meet about a quarter of an average household's energy needs. That means in the long run, huge cuts to your energy bill. In February 2022, WeDo Solar launched their product in Germany, and early interest was strong. Then, just a few days later, Russia invaded Ukraine.
As soon as the war started, people really panicked. The demand just went sky high. We were sold out for quite some time until we basically could get more product in here.
Last year, after Russia cut off gas supplies to Europe, energy prices soared. Suddenly, everyone was thinking about energy independence. For many individuals, that meant bringing solar power home. And for the federal government, it meant a new renewable energy target, getting all of the country's electricity from renewable sources by 2035. To make that happen, Germany adopted a new set of ambitious energy policies last spring. that included removing value-added taxes on solar panels, which has kept WeDo Solar busy. Atspadina, who's Ukrainian, sees these policies as a silver lining to the war.
It is unfortunate that this shift is happening because of the war and because of such a sad situation. But sometimes I feel like something needs to happen for people to move and for people to change. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Germany's new energy policy did something else. It classified switching to renewable energy as a matter of public safety that can override other public interests, like preserving views. That means that the government has new power to mandate changes. One being discussed now is requiring electricity-based heat pumps instead of gas boilers in new or updated heating systems.
So this is something they need to do because otherwise they will not get their targets.
That's Henrik Boister, a spokesperson at the city's grid operator, Stromnetz Berlin. He says that switching to heat pumps is simply necessary to reach Germany's climate goals. But the policy has been extremely controversial, partly because heat pumps are expensive.
In Germany, in general, we are not so flexible when it comes to change. So this is something people said, okay, I have to do something and it will be expensive for me. So I think this is what people might fear.
Boister says that politicians should take a lesson from the success of solar and offer citizens incentives to opt in. Berlin, for example, is offering a 500 euro credit for installing at-home solar.
Not to say we force you to change your heating, but like they do in Berlin, with the bonus, if you want to purchase your at-home solar panels, so you feel free and you get something.
As part of its new renewable energy policy, Germany is also betting big on wind power. In the next decade, they plan to double their onshore wind capacity. That means that outside of cities, the German landscape is undergoing a transformation.
All these wind turbines that you can see here, they all belong to Veltheim.
That's Kathleen Thompson, tour guide of Veltheim, Germany's first energy self-sufficient town. As we drive past acres of massive wind turbines, she tells me that since the town bought its first one in 1995, it's added 54 more that help keep the lights on throughout Germany.
You know, we use less than 1% of the electricity that is being generated here in Veltheim.
For Germany to reach its goals, more places need to look like Veltheim. But in most nearby towns and nationwide, rural Germans have protested the intrusion of wind. With hundreds of lawsuits stalling projects, the federal government will likely use its newly mandated power to push wind through. But Veltheim's mayor, Michael Kneipp, tells me there's another way. If towns can lead their own change, everyone benefits.
Weil wir zum richtigen Zeitpunkt die Lücken im Gesetz gefunden haben.
In the 1990s, he says, it wasn't so bureaucratic or expensive for a town to produce its own power. Starting in the mid-2010s, new regulations meant a shift in ownership from local citizens to large corporations.
Heute, also wenn ich jetzt so weit wäre, dass ich sage, wir haben alles gemacht wie damals.
To Kneipp, getting local buy-in should mean letting people literally buy in, whether that's sharing ownership, like in Veltheim, or at least paying neighbors for building near their land. Germany may be learning that lesson. Its updated renewable energy policy includes new incentives and protections for community-owned renewables. And the government is simplifying the approval process for wind, solar, and other projects. As German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said in a speech last year, the country sees Putin's war as an accelerator of necessary change. For the world, I'm Brett Simpson in Berlin.
Now, despite Germany's push toward renewables, recent estimates from the federal government show it still needs to move faster. If not, Germany will fall short of its 2030 goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Explore more of our reporting on the environmental impacts of the war in Ukraine online. You can find us at theworld.org.
The news can be disorienting, and it can be really hard to remember how we got here. That's why we started the Throughline podcast. Every week, we take you on a cinematic trip into the past to better understand the present. Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
You ever been there when an uncomfortable question about race comes up, but you don't know how to answer? That's where Code Switch lives. Each week, we're talking about race and how it intersects with every other aspect of your life, from politics and pop culture to history and food. Listen now to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
Addressing global warming can feel overwhelming or even futile, so we look to examples of real and rapid change.
And the extraordinary thing is that within 14 years, what had been a wasteland was filled with green, and 2 million people were brought out of poverty.
A story of environmental transformation in China, still ahead on the world. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We're spending the hour today looking at solutions to climate change. Now, when people talk about solutions, cutting climate warming emissions often gets the most attention, and it definitely gets the most funding. But there is another important part of this story: adaptation, helping communities and individuals deal with the changes they're already seeing. That includes hotter summers, less predictable rainfall, and more intense storms. Now, for farmers in India, small greenhouses are part of the solution. One nonprofit there is helping to protect crops from heat and storms with inexpensive, simplified greenhouses. Reporter Sushmita Patak has our story from southern India.
It's a windy day at Syed Sajjad Ali's farm in the southern Indian state of Telangana. In a small patch of land, about 1/8 of an acre, there are rows and rows of vines with bunches of juicy greenish-red tomatoes. The crops are inside a greenhouse.
This is protected from the sun, protected from the rain, it is protected from insects.
But this is no ordinary greenhouse. It's a low-cost, scaled-down version of a standard greenhouse made specifically for small farmers, and is the brainchild of an Indian startup called Kheti. It all started some 10 years ago when Kheti's co-founders were trying to figure out what Indian farmers were struggling with the most. Here's co-founder Soumya, who goes by one name.
And that's when we started talking to like hundreds of farmers across the country, and all of them said something that was related to climate change.
So Soumya and her colleagues decided to work on something that would help make farmers more resilient to climate change.
We looked at a bunch of things. We looked at insurance, we looked at different seeds. We also came across the greenhouse, which had been around for, you know, many centuries.
Greenhouses help crops grow more efficiently by maintaining a controlled temperature and humidity environment. They also protect crops from pests and unpredictable weather. But in India, only rich farmers can afford greenhouses. They also don't come in small sizes. So Soumya and her colleagues decided to make a much smaller, more affordable greenhouse.
Get rid of a lot of these excess features that they make for big greenhouses. Like the height, like usually you'll see greenhouses are very big, very tall, reinforced with a lot of steel. So we said, okay, can we remove this? And it was kind of like that whole like negotiation where we said, okay, what is the bare minimum covered structure that we can make? That was the approach.
Along with the greenhouse, Kheti also provides farmers with seeds, fertilizers, drip irrigation system, and installation help. Kheti's experts also advise and train farmers.
Because small farmers, again, they don't have market access. They don't know what inputs to buy. So then we said, okay, we'll bundle services with the product. And that's why we called it the Greenhouse in a Box.
Last year, Kheti's Greenhouse in a Box was among the winners of the Earthshot Prize that honors environmental solutions. So far, about 1,000 farmers across India have signed up for it. Syed Sajjad Ali got his greenhouse 7 months ago, and he's already seeing the results.
The size of tomato and the quality of tomato is much better than open field. Buyers very quickly take my tomatoes because they like this one.
Everyone wants your tomatoes.
Wants tomatoes like this.
But no one seems to want Renuka's tomatoes, growing just a few miles away. They're smaller. She planted them in an open patch, not in a greenhouse. For several weeks now, the going rate for tomatoes at her local village market has been a paltry 5 rupees or around 6 cents per kilo. Factoring in transport and labor costs, she will make a loss selling at those prices. So she's leaving them in the field to rot. Water wasted, fertilizer wasted, seedlings wasted. I get angry when I look at this, she says. Kheti's greenhouse can help farmers get higher prices by allowing them to grow in the off-season when most people are not growing and the supply is low. A few years ago, Renuka saw a Kheti greenhouse at a relative's farm and decided to get one herself. She used up a chunk of her savings, buying it for around $600, and planted cucumbers in it. It is too hot to grow cucumbers in the open, she says. But in the greenhouse, she got a pretty good harvest. Cucumbers sell for higher prices than the vegetables she usually grows. And over two crop cycles, she says she's almost recovered her investment. Next time, she hopes to make her first profit.
I think we need more and more greenhouses. There is no doubt about it.
Anjani Kumar is with the International Food Policy Research Institute in New Delhi. He says the small greenhouse is a good idea, but it is only suitable for farmers who grow fruits and vegetables. Others may have to take up poultry or livestock to supplement their incomes. As the climate changes, the government should also promote professions other than agriculture in rural areas, he says.
So that they can work in the farm, they can work off the farm, and combined they can have better income.
Whatever the solution, Kumar says government policies must take into consideration the needs of smallhold farmers.
They are going to be the most significant part for the foreseeable future for Indian agriculture.
And Kethi wants to make these small farmers climate smart. Over the next couple of years, the startup plans to get its greenhouses to 10,000 farmers. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Telangana, India.
Our climate solutions coverage runs the gamut from stories about the promise and peril of carbon credits to countries taking their climate fight to the courts. You can read all of that coverage on our website. That's at theworld.org/bigfix. The news about climate change is, not to state the obvious, often dire and getting more so every day. But author Judith Schwartz has spent years spotting the good news on global warming and the environment, including how natural ecosystems can be restored to help regulate our climate. That's the topic of her 2020 book, The Reindeer Chronicles. She spoke to The World's Marco Werman when her book was published.
In your stories, in your writing, Judy, you focus on something you call Earth Repair. You describe it as a grassroots response to evolving crises, an antidote to despair. Explain what you mean by earth repair and how you see it as one solution to climate change.
Yeah, so when I talk about earth repair, it basically means healing our landscapes and our seascapes. And the thing is that we hear about all this devastating news, but one thing that has been neglected in our conversations about climate is the role of functioning ecosystems to climate regulation. And the reason that this is good news is that it gives us tremendous agency because we know that we can restore ecosystems from huge landscapes like in China, where an area the size of Belgium was returned to ecological health, to smaller projects and places. And ecological health on every scale matters.
So functioning ecosystems where things are working. You mentioned China and the Loess Plateau, this area around the Yellow River that stretches across seven provinces and what happened there starting in the 90s. Talk about that restoration. What did it look like? How did it happen? And what did you learn from reporting this story?
This is an area where it was the breadbasket of China, and it's actually where agriculture developed in China 10,000 years ago. And over all that time, the land has degraded to the point where you see images of people bringing their goats up hillsides where maybe there's a few blades of grass. And the Yellow River was silting up, and it was a real disaster. So the Chinese government, in conjunction with numerous international entities, including the World Bank, decided that rather than have this ongoing problem, they would restore the landscape. They used some very simple approaches. They terraced the land so that the water would flow more slowly and water would be held in the landscape. They removed animals from where they had been overgrazing so that the land would have a chance to rebound. And they had local people planting trees and planting other kinds of vegetation. And the extraordinary thing is that within 14 years, what had been a wasteland was filled with green, and 2 million people were brought out of poverty.
What were the downsides of that when it came to actually executing it?
Well, it was an ongoing challenge to do anything on such a large scale. There is, of course, a lot of, you know, trial and error. But overall, the project was a huge success. And in fact, one of my motivations for writing this book was to make it clear that these kinds of projects are happening. We may not see them. You know, it's not a dramatic one-day news story, but all over the world, people are experimenting. They are enhancing the climate resilience of their landscapes. They are turning wastelands into places where people can grow their own food and live their own lives with dignity.
Practically every day on our show, we cover environmental disasters and the daunting challenge of climate change. Why is highlighting these success stories important to you when there are literally fires that urgently need to be dealt with?
Well, one thing is that I think it's so important for people to even know that it's possible to restore landscapes. Land is never static. It's always in the process of changing. And by working with natural processes, we can help to restore those landscapes. And in doing so, restore climate regulation. I think it's really important for us to be curious about how land works, and that can help us address problems such as fires by not being just reactive with all of these different tragedies that are unfolding before our eyes, but to also think about landscapes, think about how these lands might be restored, look at who is out there doing the restoring and what we can learn from what they are doing.
Science journalist Judith Schwartz speaking there to The World's Marco Werman. Next, we have a specific example of one effort to restore an imperiled ecosystem, the Amazon rainforest. It's sometimes called the lungs of the planet, but it's been subjected to deforestation and agriculture, and that has broken the forest into fragments and damaged its ability to store carbon or to provide a home to plants and animals. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has made it his goal to balance agribusiness and the health of the forest. Michael Fox reported this story last winter on the tension between economic interests and climate change in the Amazon basin.
Valdemar de Assis corrals his herd of cattle back into their pen after a day in the field. He's a family farmer whose land runs alongside the Trans-Amazon Highway in the Amazonian state of Pará. The lush forest here was cut decades ago amid a government push to open up the jungle. De Assis grew up here on a farm. Today, he says he has about 300 cows. Milk cows and the calves, he says. I milk the cows in the morning. I start around 4 a.m. The milk is already out the door by 6. He provides milk to the local community. His farm is about 100 acres. That's small for the Amazon, still considered a family farm. He raises pigs, sheep, chickens, corn and vegetables, even fish. But Assis's cows are his life. It's so beautiful to see them walking in front of you, and also knowing that tomorrow you're going to have a little more income. It's good. De Assis says he makes about 6,000 reais, or $1,000 a month. That's not bad for Brazil, 6 times the minimum wage. Agronomist Anderson Borges says small family farmers in the Amazon are responsible for roughly 3/4 of the products that feed local Brazilians and as much as 90% of the jobs in agriculture here. For Borges, sustainable development in areas that have already been deforested can look a lot like Valdemar de Assis's land. The key ingredient, he says, is raising a variety of crops and animals. Having a diversity of many products means you don't need to intensify the production of just one crop, so you don't need a lot of pesticides and you don't need to deforest, Borges says. Farmers like this are likely going to get a boost from Brazil's President Lula.
Nós criamos programa chamado Mais Alimentos.
That's him talking a few years back about his program Mais Alimentos, or More Food, which he launched in 2008 during his last term in office. The program supported small producers and family farmers with technical assistance, loans, and government contracts in order to increase local agricultural production. Lula has again promised to back small producers. But in the Amazon, family farmers make up just a small slice of the economy, and they have less than 1/4 of farmland in the region. Another group is king. That's Big Ag, driven by multinational companies. Brazil leads the world in exports of both beef and soybeans. They're also the top two drivers of deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. President Lula has promised to stop deforestation. It's something he's done before. In his first term in office 20 years ago, he enacted new strict regulations, inspections, land registries, and wood and meat tracking systems. Those policies helped to cut deforestation rates in half within 2 years.
Não precisamos desmatar sequer um metro de terra.
We don't need to cut down even a meter of forest to continue to be one of the biggest food producers in the world, Lula said at the COP27 summit. The president wants to roll back deforestation without kneecapping the industry. But that can be a hard needle to thread. André Cotrim is an economics professor at Pará Federal University. You can't amputate the arm of an important source of production demanding sustainable practices without offering the necessary elements for them to be implemented, he says. Sueli Araújo is the former head of Brazil's environmental protection agency, IBAMA. She says that Lula has to have a two-pronged approach against deforestation, fighting criminal actions like clear cuts and fires, while also supporting the local economy. We have to have a regional development plan for the Amazon, which shows that the government wants to generate income for residents of the region, she says, but does this with the forest still standing and with economic options that protect the forest. Araújo says that Lula did this well in 2004, and she says he's poised to do it again. The future of the Amazon rainforest largely depends on Lula's success. For the World, I'm Michael Fox.
It's warming, it's us, we're sure, it's bad, but we can fix it. That's the mantra of climate scientist Kim Nichols at Lund University in Sweden. Her 2021 book, Under the Sky We Make, aims to help people understand how they can help. She talked about it with The World's Marco Werman.
Kim, tell me more about the mantra. When do you say it? How often? And why do you say it?
So this is a phrase that I've been using for over a decade now in my teaching. It helps us orient because this is what science shows actually people need to know in order to both support more ambitious climate policy and make changes in our own lives.
In your book, you outline the five stages of climate acceptance. What are those and what inspired you to think about acceptance as a necessary step?
So I talk about the five stages of radical climate acceptance, which are ignorance, avoidance, doom, all the feels, and purpose. And that's based on both my experience and on research from psychology. What I've seen is that people can get really stuck in the first stages of either not knowing about the problem or knowing about it and being afraid to confront it or face it. I think the feelings there are really at the heart of that, and going from what we know about the facts to experiencing all these feelings and harness those feelings for action and actually stabilizing the climate.
We also know the effects of climate change do not impact everyone equally. We've reported that on the show quite a bit. And crucially, some of us are more guilty than others for causing the climate crisis, whether we know it or not. Who are the climate privileged, and how do you encourage people to confront their climate privilege, shall we say?
Well, I am one of the climate privileged, and that was something that has taken me some time to realize and acknowledge, because about 10% of the global population are responsible for almost half of household climate pollution. It's those who have incomes over about $38,000 a year that are in the top 10% of income globally. And the more income you earn, the higher your climate pollution tends to be.
Is it about flying in planes or food or in particular driving habits?
So our research has shown that the three highest impact personal climate actions that someone can take to quickly cut their own climate pollution are to go flight, car, and meat-free. Any reduction you can make in those three areas makes a really big and important difference for the climate.
Kim, I'm curious about your own journey to confronting your own contribution to the problem. Was it facing these statistics about personal carbon budgets, or was it another aha moment?
Well, maybe the biggest one for me was flying. I mean, I'm a recovering frequent flyer. So in 2010, I took 15 round-trip flights. But once I decided to stop flying within Europe, adventure and romance actually followed from that. So I met my husband in 2016, and we ended up basically having a wedding by train, where he comes from Canada, I come from California, we have friends and family all over. But instead of asking them all to fly to us, we went to them by train. Almost no one else had to travel, and we went by train between them. But yeah, it was really lovely.
Climate scientist Kim Nichols at Lund University in Sweden, talking there with Marco Werman. We're going to leave you today with music meant to unite people in the face of the climate crisis. It's by jazz and electronic musician Eloise Suzanne, who performs under the stage name Dilou. She's from the island of Réunion, the French territory in the Indian Ocean. She talked to the world a couple years ago after contributing a track called Yella Mama to a Greenpeace project called DJs for Climate. Here's Dilou.
I used a Mauritian beach. I like that. There was the voices of the people of Papua New Guinea. All the rhythmical sounds are from the sample pack, so it goes like cap, cap. Rhythmically it goes a bit like that, and all of these short sounds are a clap of Arctic ice, or the kicks are percussions, like some Arctic turns. So like the rhythmical bass is really made from the samples. The song is called Yella Mama. I like collaboration. If I have to do something about climate, the most important thing that, to me, we have to understand living on Earth is that we're not alone and we can do things all together. So that was the first step. I met this guy, Lasana, and he's the singer of a famous band called Synapson. He sang in Wolof, which is language from Senegal. So the lyrics are about Earth and what we are doing to Mother Earth and how we need to respect it and save it. Then I was like, okay, I like the Wolof sound and it's amazing, but I need something from my island. I need Creole. And I called a friend called Justine Mauvin. This part, the Creole part, mostly is about how we used to use nature for our good and now how we use nature blindly and how we are demolishing it, basically. Réunion Island, where I'm from, cyclones, typhoons, hurricanes, they don't come when they used to come. The heat period is like shifted as well. We went scuba diving. I was really proud to show my island to my girlfriend at the time, and we went like snorkeling. I went back in the water after like 10 years, you know, and I started swimming, and she did too, and she was like, whoa, there's nothing here, like... He told me it was super beautiful and full of fishes, and the reef was like super colorful and everything. And I watched it and I was like, whoa, this is nothing like when I was a kid. Everything has changed. I was shocked. Like, I was shocked. And I really started to ask myself why and how could we prevent that? Talk about ecology or stuff like that, and people start being like, huh, people expect you to only talk about negative things, you know. And I think that making it fun and joyful is really important too. Like, yes, it's dramatic. Yes, it's really sad. But the actions that we're taking, making the change, could be joyful and beautiful.
Musician Dilou with her song Yella Mama. Our story was produced by Ian Koss and Anna Kusmer. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Thanks for joining us for this special edition of the show, whether you're back at work today or enjoying the day off. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will see you right back here on Monday.
A quick note before we go. We are in the middle of our fall fundraising drive and need your help.
A generous donor has set a challenge match for us. If we are able to raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. Every gift counts towards our goal. I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.